accession number 27208, Reel 4.
But read, Reel 4. Another thing you mentioned was training in air combat.
Yes.
What would that entail?
Well, two of you would go up together and break apart and then approach one another. I seem to remember camera guns and attempt to shoot the other one down, which could be quite exciting. You used to, well, you would attack the other, and would break off and try another attack. And eventually, it seems so often that you finished up going round and round in circles, chasing each other's tails, neither able to get to get his camera gun on the other one. That was the usual thing.
What happened when you'd finished working up in South Africa? What was the next move?
We embarked in a carrier and went out to Trincomalee in Ceylon, as it then was, Ceylon Harbour.
What was the carrier?
The Empress. There were two of them. Empress and the Emir, both of them, I think.
And did you disembark again in Trincomalee?
No, lived in the ship. Comfortable ship, made in America. Quarters were comfortable, food was good. A bit cramped. Had been a merchant ship converted to carrier, so it wasn't over large. Big enough, but just not very fast, not fast enough. Because you used to have to, for the operations that we were doing, you was in the main across the Indian Ocean and towards Malaysia and Nicobar Islands, and we had to have 24 knots of wind over the deck to safely be able to get the aircraft off. And the ship only went at 12 knots, so I can remember the meteorological officer coming out with his little a wind vane, handheld wind vanes, it's finding out what the wind was across the deck, and the ship would steer for the nearest bit of cloud to try and get a bit more wind to allow the aircraft to be flown off. So usually, of course, there was maybe 10 or 12 knots of wind, but if there wasn't any wind, it was a problem for the poor old commander flying and ship's captain.
How many aircraft was the carrier carrying? Was it just your squadron?
Just our squadron, yeah. I think it was 12. I think so.
Was there any difficulties operating from such a small carrier?
Yes. Well, the other thing was, of course, that if we didn't have wind off the deck, I'd forgotten about that, we could still operate because, I think it must have been the landing that was a feature, because we had a catapult and we used to be shot off this catapult.
How did that operate then?
Steam, the steam driven catapult. Still used.
And what would you do with the steam? What would the aircraft have to be doing while it was sitting in the catapult? Would it have to be, would you have to have it a certain number of revs, or would you have to be
Well, you go to the end of the catapult and you sit there with the engine ticking over while a strop is attached to a hook and a suitable place underneath the aircraft, and the other end to the catapult itself, and you sit there and you put your head behind you against the, you must have your head against the headrest because of the jolt when you go off, and you sit there and you watch for the officer in charge, and he rotates his flag, and he rotates his flag faster and faster, and as he does so, you rev the engine up to full power, and when it's at full power and when the officer in charge is satisfied, he drops his hand with the flag in it and the catapult operates and off you go. And it leaves the end of the deck, and the strop from, hopefully the strop will come off and drop into the sea, and you're then airborne. But it's very exciting. Very exciting.
And the operations that you started to be engaged in, what did they involve?
Oh, that was rockets, machine guns and bombs against ground targets in where Port Swettenham, and where's that? There's a place that's now a holiday resort that we used to bomb not infrequently, and the coast of Malaysia, and the Nicobar Islands, used to bomb them happily. But the Japanese are good gunners.
What targets were you actually attacking?
Airfields and railway trains, ground installations of that we reckoned were the Japanese bases, that sort of thing.
Were you able to see much on the ground when you were attacking?
Yeah.
Did they use camouflage at all much?
Yes. And I think they built dummy aeroplanes for us to bomb, which looked like Zeros, but we bombed them anyway because we didn't know any better.
You said they were good gunners.
Yes.
How good a gunners were they?
Well, they managed to shoot down my commanding officer when I was one of the group of four. He didn't believe in weaving. He was a tough chap. He liked to go straight on. So they shot him down. I believed in weaving.
I was going to say, were there any techniques that you would have, obviously, going into attack, or could you describe to me how you would make an attack on either a train or a ground installation or dummy airfields, anything like that? Are there any rules that you would follow that you would do?
Well, we just did what we used to do in Canada when I was doing our bomb dropping. You came over the target, or you came close to the target, and then you pointed your aircraft towards it, and you went down. You had to keep straight, of course, at that point, and just hope to goodness you wouldn't get shot down doing it. And either dropped your bomb or fired your rockets or shot your machine guns or whatever you're supposed to do, and pushed off quick. I didn't do that for long. Couple of months, I think, that's all.
But you said you would weave. Where would the weaving come in?
Well, approaching the target. And before the final run in, you couldn't weave then, but approaching the target, you would.
And would you make one pass over the sights, or would you make numerous passes?
As far as I remember, one. But if you're bombing, you only have one bomb, so... that's that.
And how would the operations be organised? What would be the would you have a briefing prior to that?
Indeed, yes. There was an army major and a captain who were the intelligence officers, and it was their job to brief us on what we were supposed to be doing. And the commanding officer would also brief us. Yes, it was quite intensive.
Would they give you map references and where you would be going and the type of target that you would be attacking?
Well, it was usually somewhere where it was pretty obvious to... It was either on the coast or on an island or something. So you didn't need map references. You could find it all right. It's about looking. But you had to... You had to dress up as well, of course. You had Mae West and parachute, jungle knife, survival kit, all hanging onto you and trying to climb into a cockpit.
Would you carry a sidearm at all?
Yes, we had a revolver. 4.5, I think it was. It was a big one.
And what did your uniform look like for operating the tropics? What kind of colour was it and texture or something?
Oh, just the shirt and trousers, lightweight shirt and trousers.
Would you wear a flying helmet as well?
Oh, indeed.
And would you at all, when you were flying, would you fly, say, either on an operation prior to approaching the target, would you ever fly with the canopies back at all?
I don't remember. I don't think so. It was a bit distracting because of the wind coming roaring in. I don't think so.
And what about the markings and camouflage of your aircraft? What did they look like? Were they what particular colour were they, or were they camouflaged? Or?
No, they weren't. They were navy blue. I think they had a white stripe on them. No, they weren't camouflaged. The great thing was to be sufficiently identifiable to the gunners on board the ship, who were a bit inclined to shoot at anything they didn't recognise, and if they didn't recognise, as they didn't on one occasion, the squadron coming back, they'd fire at them, which, they, as I say, they did once. It didn't happen. They weren't good enough to shoot any down, but they did have a go.
Was there a threat from Japanese fighters at all at that stage?
Not from fighters, no. No. In fact, I only saw one Japanese aircraft, apart from the ones on the ground. And that was the only time I saw a kamikaze one. And that was when we were in a squadron of ships, and the cruiser ahead of me, I think it was the Sussex, memory is so bad, had an attack by a kamikaze. And I was on the flight deck at the time. I saw this chap coming out of the, because the Sussex are dead ahead of us, coming out of the sky and coming down towards the stern of this ship. But he chickened out at the last minute. Instead of hitting the ship solidly, he bounced off the rear end. Made a great mark down the side of the ship.
And were you doing these operations for 2 months prior to the end of the war?
Happily, after I'd been out there for a couple of months or so, the sensible Americans dropped their atom bomb, which I was very pleased about. Yeah.
Was that the same amongst most of your colleagues? With all
very much so.
See the end of the war.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because we were at that time involved in an operation called Operation Zipper. Have you heard of that?
And the proposed landings in Malaya.
In Malaya, which I have read one or two books on the subject afterwards. It would have been another Gallipoli, another total disaster, because the intelligence was wrong. The landing craft would have got stuck in the mud. It would have been an absolute disaster. But happily, the Americans dropped the bomb before the ships got there. My ship, in company with others, Mountbatten's gang, was about halfway across the Indian Ocean when this happened. And then all the ships stopped. And you can see right from horizon to horizon, hundreds of ships, all types and sizes. And we all stopped. And nobody knew why, but after a couple of days, we found out why. And they decided to carry on with the Zipper. But, unfortunately, the catapult broke on my ship. And so we went back to Trincomalee Harbour, and the rest of them carried on. And, of course, all the officers were presented with samurai swords by the surrendering Japanese. But we didn't get any, because we were back in Trinco Harbour.
So when did you return to the UK?
Sometime after the... Well, you know how it is, with a sudden end to something, and nobody's really prepared to know what to do. So we were at the ship. There again, we were disadvantaged, because the ship went to Australia to pick up stores, bring back to benighted Britain, starving Britain, leaving us behind. So we part this time on shore at Trincomalee, and was it one of the Singhalese airfields? Anyway, I can't remember which one. And we were doing sort of desultory flying, just to keep our thanks, dear. keep our hands in. For what reason, I'm not very sure. But anyway, to give us something to do. And then a very sad time arrived, because we had to fly these aircraft to India, to Cochin. And it was quite an interesting experience, because the squadron left the ship for the last time. Well, the ship, that must have been before it went to Australia, because we never saw it again. But before, now why was that? I've got it all mixed up, I think. But for whatever reason, when the squadron disbanded, we flew away from the ship, and the new commander, Zegers de Bail, was a very good chap, Dutchman, had flying from the mast behind his aircraft a great long decommissioning flag, about, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 feet long. And we all formated behind this, and a huge squadron did a circle round over the ship and flew up to Cochin. And when we approached Cochin, the airfield was crowded with aeroplanes. There was hardly any space left, just a runway, and odd places to park with difficulty. Hundreds and hundreds of aeroplanes all arrived at Cochin. And what they were doing was to accede to the terms of the lend-lease of these aircraft from America. And they, having signed them out, the engineers having signed them out as fully serviceable, clocks working, everything working, they were then towed on the streets. And of course the Hellcat had folding wings that could do that. They were towed out, lifted onto the deck of a carrier in the port, and the carrier with the deck covered in airplanes steamed off into the Indian Ocean, and they were all pushed over the side. Absolutely beyond belief. There they still lie, I suppose. Thousands of beautiful American airplanes.
And you returned to the UK?
Yep.
And were you demobilised when
yes.
you returned?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Had you thought of... Always. So how did you come to leave the Fleet Air Arm when you were demobilised?
Oh, we went to Wimslow, as far as I remember. We returned all our kit. Everything was signed in, including the revolver, I think. No, I think we had got rid of that before that. And given a rather shapeless demob suit, a trilby hat, and suitable shirt, trousers, and that sort of thing. Told to push off, as far as I remember. Don't say a great ceremony about it.
Had you had the opportunity to stay on at all?
No.
That wasn't given to you at all?
No.
Would you have liked to have stayed in the...
No.
Did you want to return, obviously, to civilian life?
Yes. Mm.
How do you feel now, though, having served with the Fleet Air Arm during the Second World War?
It was a fantastic experience that I wouldn't have missed. It really was. It gave you an opportunity to see the world, opened your eyes, the best university one could have had, met wonderful friends, and...
And I believe the Fleet Air Arm Officers Association is a very closely knit group of people as well.
Hmm, I think so. Especially in New Zealand. A tenth of the officers in the Fleet Air Arm are New Zealanders. And I still keep in touch with my NZ pals and my Canadian pal.
Thank you very much, Bill.